accession number 32369, reel 17.
Mr. Cassidy, reel 17. Well, you were in Cyprus. You did mention, I think, that the Turks seemed to be a bit more friendlier towards you than the Greek element. Did you have any problems in the normal meeting of Greeks and Turks? Were they aggressive towards you or any of that nature?
No, I think we always knew that the Turks were the poor man's pact of these two races of people, and I suppose that's why we looked more favourable on the Turks than we did the Greeks. The Greeks seemed to be the ones who did all the complaining because of their wealth, and probably it was true that the Turks were jealous of the wealth that the Greeks had, and now and again they would try to take a bit off them, you know. But it was mainly disputes in land and property that we were involved in, or where we were asked to calm the situation down. I mean, of course, they had their own courts and everything like that, but some of the skirmishes that came up were between families who were living close together. You would have a Greek family and a Turkish family, and of course all sorts of things happen then with friction between the families, or if one of the Turks' families' children was playing with one of the Greeks' families' children, and something went wrong, then it was surprising how quickly it could turn from a small incident into a major incident to them. And although we didn't really have to be involved in any of the court cases as such, we tried to calm the situation down as much as we can. And of course, this was just only one of the hearts and minds exercise that we were in Cyprus for with the United Nations. The other, of course, was ensuring that the two communities were kept apart, and consequently in the different areas of Cyprus, which was, although at that time was not split up, it did have their own communities with their own boundaries, and we had or the United Nations had strategic placed sentry boxes and checkpoints throughout the island, and we were moved around from one place to another to man these checkpoints, mainly during the day, but a few also 24 hours where we needed radio communications and such as that. And also in Nicosia, where the British consul was, we were involved in the duties there of guarding the British ambassador to Cyprus as well, which was a lot of spit and polish and a monotonous routine of guard and then changing the guard and what have you. On the whole, we preferred, like a lot of the DLI lads did, was to be out on the move in Cyprus, moving round and keeping an eye on things around the country. And of course, we donned our own insignia while we were over there with the blue berries of the United Nations and the khaki and a blue cravat, and we had shorts and trousers as well with a khaki uniform. We had Dobie Wallace, who looked after our uniform and washed it as well and starched it, so when we had it to go out, it was all prim and clean and what have you. And these Dobie Wallace followed us and stayed in the camps where we were and provided a service on top of the cookhouse rule, because they would be there 24 hours. So once our main meal had finished at 4 o'clock, when it come round to 7 or 8 o'clock at night, you could always go and up to the Dobie Waller's hut and say, "Well, can you make us an egg sandwich or a sausage sandwich?" And it was amazing the different things that they had on offer at a price, of course, and you could fill yourself up with or top yourself up with their sandwiches and everything as well.
Were these Greek or Turks?
These were Indian, and for some reason they latched onto the battalion, and I think they've been in Cyprus for a long time, and they were non-committal to the Greeks and the Turks, although they didn't really communicate with either of them. The only people they did communicate with was the United Nations. Each of them were in wherever you found British troops on 798 nations, you would find these Wallers there with their different tin pots and cookers and everything, and bread and buns and everything like that, and that's how they made their living.
An opportunity to make money.
Yeah, of course, and anything that they didn't have, somehow, even cigarettes and things like that, they would get it from somewhere for you.
Did you move around Cyprus?
Yeah, we did. We wasn't a sightseeing place really, but on duty wise, we were moved quite a bit in sections. Of course, the mortar platoon then was laid dormant. Then we became riflemen, the same as the rest of the battalion, and we were doing the normal duties of heart and mind as such, and reporting back to HQ on different incidents that we'd seen and what have you. So although we did get a little bit more to work put in, it was just mainly exercises to keep us in touch with the mortar itself, and we didn't do any live firing as such or training in it. All our duties was really with the United Nations and these operational posts that we were put in demand. So it was boring in some cases, and then it changed from day to day because you were moved around quite a bit. And we saw a lot of the island, and a very beautiful island it was. We got a lot of swimming in. We got a lot of sport in with the football, the battalion football. I remember Brian Green and myself broke into the battalion football team at that time, and we got a few days playing the Greeks and the Turks at quite a bit of high level of football as well. So we were pleased with that. We attended an Anthea theatre, an outdoor music arena as such, and with music blasting around this arena all night long, all classical music it was, and we got ourselves slightly inebriated while we were sitting there all night drinking and listening to this loud music. So all in all, it was a pretty good time, but of course 6 months is quite a while to be away from home as well. So it was a big talking point when midway through Cyprus we heard that in the very near future the Durham Light Infantry 1st Battalion would become extinct. And
did this start as rumours, or were you being told actually by...
Well, once it comes out that the commanding officer will be speaking to the battalion the next day, or the company commander was speaking to the battalion or the company the next day, then of course all sorts of rumours start coming round. But in this case, I think the rumours were only that we were being disbanded, and that was all we knew until obviously it came out how it would be done, what would happen to us when we returned to Colchester, we'd become known as 4LI, and have a red backing behind our cap badge and the very, and then eventually from there we would be split up into three different regiments, calling ourselves 1, 2, or 3LI. And of course, yeah, of course, I mean, we had a resettlement officer who was heavily involved then, because the other thing that came out was the word which nobody had even thought of, but everybody knew what it was, called redundancy. And that was offered to some of the our seven members as well, who had been in for a while and all that. And I remember one incident with one of our, with Ronnie Holmes, in our regiment, went it carried on for months and months before it was sold, because he'd asked for to be made redundant. And the other thing, of course, was we knew that we would be offered, or what the regiment would try to place us with the choice of where we wanted to move to when we were disbanded. And that included either going to a corps, which was the Royal Artillery, the Royal Army Service Corps, place like that, or to either 1, 2 and 3LI. And from then on, I think all talking that was done in the NAFI and out on patrol and everywhere else was about the disbandment and where we would prefer to go and where we would be prefer to join, because the big point of choosing 1, 2, or 3LI, of course, was where they were based at and where they were going to be posted to.
What was your immediate reaction when you did realise, well, this is the end of the regiment?
I think it was a shock and disbelief at first. We knew we'd done, over the years, of course, we're serving with the regiment and the traditions of the Durham Light Infantry, the high order that we'd carried out our duties in wherever we were sent. And we knew we'd done well in Borneo and everywhere we'd been, and we just couldn't believe and understand why they were disbanding a regiment with as many honours as the Durham Light Infantry, you know. And we were asking questions about this, and we never seemed to get an answer. And we...
Did you feel, you know, looking back now, that the fight to retain the regiment hadn't been put on very strongly, you know?
That was the big point, yes. Yeah. We felt that if it had been, and this is the trouble with rumours like that one, where we'd heard that the London regiments had all been saved because of this big shake-up, because they have a lot of MPs and people who've got high positions in Parliament and places like that were either previous servant members of their battalions, or they were part of the old boys network, whereas the Durham Light Infantry County Regiment had nobody in as such of any power to stand up for them and fight a battle for them, which was obviously the biggest battle the Durham Light Infantry had for a long time. And it was amazing, really, because we've been getting new recruits in, to see some of the young recruits who had come to join the regiment as well, who were sucked into this sort of scenario that we had, where we were going to be disbanded. We were actually, we put it down as the family was being split up, and it was just, it was like a family at home being split up. And we were very controlled anger, I would say, because we were writing home and asking people or asking friends and parents and relations what was happening about the Durham Light Infantry. Is you know, because obviously there was bulletins coming out that the association and people like that were fighting for the regiment to be not to be disbanded, and different permutations, what they could do to hold the county name and everything like that. And of course we were, but the main thing was that, you know, not one of these big generals or anything like that was standing up for the regiment, and we just couldn't understand that at all. And until later, I mean, until we realised, I suppose, that things were going to take its course, and we were going to be disbanded, and there was nothing on, nobody could do about it. And we then settled into a mode of picking and choosing which regiment we were going to go to, and we knew it wouldn't be the same either. Yeah. I mean, 1, 2, and 3 alive, even the names of it don't. We've always been Durham Light Infantry, you know, and we were proud of it as well, everybody was. And to lose that identity was absolutely devastating. And I know we felt it in the junior ranks, but in the senior ranks, I mean, they were even more despondent about everything. And I wouldn't say a gloom of despondency settled over the regiment. What you've got to remember was, we at that time when we heard about this happening, we weren't even in the Durham Light Infantry, our own uniform. We were serving for in the United Nations, so I suppose probably that softened the blow a little bit, in as much as we weren't really in the mode of the DLI at that time. But certainly when we got back, we soon found out that you know, things were moving along faster than what we had actually thought.
When did you leave Cyprus?
We left in, would be about 68, in the midterm of Cyprus when we came back, and returned to our place of mode, of our Colchester again, and sent on leave to dwell known. But by then we'd just about picked out our regiment that we would be joining when we came back off leave.
When you went on leave, was the county itself seething over the fact that the regiment was going, or was it just apathy? Yeah?
I think it was a lot of apathy. Mm. I can always remember reading letters to the editor in the Sunderland Echo and what have you, about what a shame it was that the county was losing its regiment. But all in all, I don't think there was very much done, what should have been done. I mean, looking back now, and looking back what other regiments did and how they were saved, I mean, I don't think Durham did anything at all, really. It was just accepted, right, we're here, we take orders, and we don't, you know, we don't answer back, and we accept it, and that's it. So
by now you'd obviously thought about it, and you'd have a choice to make.
Yep, we had the big choice was to have a look where 1 ally was going, where 2 ally was going, and where 3 ally was going. I don't think I was really interested in the corps, although afterwards I regretted not picking out one of the service corps to go into. Because, I mean, at that time, I knew that very soon I'd be promoted to sergeant. And I was still not really committed at home with any, with a wife or family or anything like that. So these sort of things didn't cross my mind. And it was just a case of, well, as I'm going where I'm told to go, and that's it. And
so what was your particular choice?
I chose 1 ally.
Why did you do that? Why 1 ally?
Because one thing, they were going to go to Kenya for an exercise for about 4 or 6 weeks. And two, they were stationed in, or they were due to be stationed in Northern Ireland, which at that time was, there wasn't much going on, really. You know, it was a quiet place, and it was just part of the United Kingdom, really. So I said, well, I'm sick of travelling, and Ireland is within touch of the UK, so it's easy to get back home if you want to, and the people speak the same language as us, so why not? And it was amazing, and I think the majority of the regiment at that time chose Wanalei, only because the other thing we'd been told was that Wanalei was made up with a lot of northeast people anyway as well, so it would be like going from home to home.
And where was it stationed? Where was it based?
At that time, they were in the UK somewhere. I can't remember where they were, but they were due and getting ready to go to Northern Ireland, Ballykinla. That's where they were due to go to. So we said we'll have to leave and everything like that. And after we get settled in Colchester, and we were then known as 4LI.
So at Colchester, you were 4LI.
Yes.
And then you had to make a choice then as to which one you were wanting to
go to. And overnight we became, personally, we became either 1, 2 or 3LI. And Colchester was a funny time then, because people were leaving or talking about where they were going to every day, you know. Their postings would come through. I'm going with the Royal Military Police. We're doing some training, staff training and whatever. And it was amazing where the regiment was being split up and the different places where they're going. And of course it wasn't just the junior ranks that were getting split up, it was the senior ranks as well and the officers. So every day battalion orders were put out and on the notice boards and circulated, and everybody took an avid interest in, and comrades whereabouts they were, if the posting had come through, and when they were leaving, and where they were going to join their new regiment at. And
it must have been a difficult time, because you were waiting for this news, as you say, all of you, including the officers. Your spirits must have been worked up and down.
Very low because I would think some of the diehard, especially in the warrant officers and sergeants mess, of course a lot of people hadn't accepted the fact that we were going to be disbanded, and it was mainly from those quarters where in the heart of the battalion, the sergeant's mess. I think it was more in the sergeant's mess because of the senior people of the battalion, really. They were very despondent about things that were happening, and a lot of our information came from there, those quarters as well. But it was a funny atmosphere with the battalion, in as much as we weren't doing exercises or ceremonial duties or anything like that. The whole battalion, from top to bottom, was involved in this massive disbandment and disbursement procedure that was taking place. And of course, at that time, I'd already picked out that I was going to Wanalei, and a lot of my friends that I'd made, some of them were close to the end of their terms of engagement, i.e. they were all regulars, but they were getting close to their 6-year and 9-year disengagement. So some of them were actually getting ready for to be demobbed as such, you know, to end the army altogether. And the thing what was happening in the regiment was that the Durham Light Infantry didn't want to lose these servant soldiers who were, you know, who were very good. But because of this, what was happening, a lot of them took the attitude, well, if the regiment's going, then I'm going as well. It'll never be the same. And never took up the option to be put with another regiment. The thing that happened with me at that time was also the news had come through that I was to be promoted, and my promotion would come through before I was to join my new regiment, 1LI, in Ballykinler in Northern Ireland. So this more or less took my mind off things that were happening around us, and it is a big step to go from corporal to sergeant. So I just concentrated on what was coming off and what I had to do. And then, of course, 1LI, when it was confirmed, the people who were going to go to them also, we then were given this option to go. Well, it wasn't an option. We were sent on exercise to Kenya, which was a really enterprising time of my life to travel that far.
Yeah. We'll come to that shortly. Yeah, just to finish this off. And what about the final march, the final parade for the regiment? Did you take part in that?
Oh yes, we were. Of course, what happened also at that time was that the new Tyne Tunnel had been built in Newcastle, and we were given the honour to be on guard at one side of the tunnel, and the Northumberland Fusiliers took the other side of the tunnel. So we enjoyed rehearsing for that, although it wasn't much of a ceremony to take part in, but at least we were getting a free ride back to the northeast, and also we knew that after the opening of the tunnel we'd be given a good slap of feed, and then we would find out from the horse's mouth as well what was happening and what people were saying about the regiment as well. So we had that in. We were also told that the laying up of the colours would take place in the December after a service at Durham Cathedral. We would be presented to the Princess Alexandra, and the colours would be laid up. And of course that was the main thing that we were rehearsing for at Colchester, for the ceremony of the laying up of the colours. And the whole battalion, as such, before it dispersed, was involved in that. And I don't think there was many people who were excused duties to miss the parade as such. And we knew it was going to be a big day for the regiment. And also we were told that after the trooping of the colour, we would march through the city of Durham, and then we would be dismissed. We would no longer be the DLI, and we would be able to go on. After we'd handed our weapons in, we would go straight on leave.
And the crowds that were there, was it an emotional event?
Yes, it was absolutely tremendous. We walking through Durham that morning, we weren't walking, we were bussed up to the cathedral. And the crowds that lined the streets even before we went in the cathedral was unbelievable. The service I can't remember much about, because it seemed to pass very quickly. And there's two or three more or less lectures on the regiment itself and the honours it had done, and how as a fighting unit it had been over the years. But even then, there was no real anger or anything or protest about what the government was doing to the county regiment. And what brought it to home was, to myself personally then, was when we were on the Palace Green and we had trooped the colour and we were marching down the streets of Durham, I was looking at the faces of some of the crowd, and I can still remember seeing some of the older generation, old comrades and ex-DLI, with tears in their eyes, and it really did you know, bring a lump to your throat.